Session number 3167.
So Aubrey Elwood, Reel 4. Was there a good deal of contact in Quetta between the civilian and the service elements in the European community?
You mean over matters of business and
yes, anything.
Or social business.
Yeah.
Oh, we knew a good a lot of the civilians very well, of course, as socially. And there must have been contact, of course, between the people of the highest ranks who were responsible for our for the services and for those in the civilian direction of the civilian affairs. But I should say, in a way, possibly less there, because it was a quieter place. There wasn't so much tribal troubles. There were occasionally tribal troubles, but not so frequently as they occurred in Peshawar and Northwest Frontier. So I should think the contacts on what I call the business level were rather less. But we knew people very well. They all belonged to the same club and all that sort of thing, and we made friends with them, met them socially a great deal.
You were once again, as regards a service role, this was once again an army cooperation type of work. Had there been any developments in army cooperation? You referred to one earlier on about messages. This kind of developments in army cooperation work since your previous tour?
Well, in principle, they were very much the same. There was certain equipment had been introduced. For instance, radio telephony had been brought in by then, and you could do a reconnaissance and report by radio telephony instead of doing it with a key. Now here my memory's gone wrong again, and I can't quite remember when it came to spotting for guns. I'm not sure whether we didn't still use the key because the code was perhaps easier, but I'm really so vague about it that I've forgotten. In fact, I'm vague about, as I told you before, quite a lot of this, because it is entirely by memory. When you get to details of that sort, it's very difficult to remember exactly what happened.
Was it, in fact, that was the radio telephony fairly unreliable at that stage?
Well, I always found it very difficult to use because I couldn't hear what the other chap was saying. But it wasn't, of course, anything like as good as it is now. And I can't always hear what they say now myself. But it is much better, much clearer than it was. But sometimes it was terribly difficult to hear in those days. But that was one of the things. And then we did have, as I mentioned, this method of picking up messages from the ground instead of only dropping them.
How did that work?
On a hook. You let down a hook, a big hook from the aeroplane, and flew very low, and it would catch onto a piece of string or wire, whatever it was, on two poles. You had to make your run so that you got between the two poles, and your stick would be trailing down and would catch the string in the middle and bring out the message. Then your observer wound it into the bottom of the fuselage and extracted the message, and there you were.
Did that require a lot of practice to get that?
A bit of practice. It wasn't very difficult. I remember one... I was a flight commander in those days at first, and I remember one chap, an awfully nice young man who was a South African, and he just couldn't get it for some reason or another. I don't know. I had to take him up myself and do it, and then he got a bit better. Eventually he got it all right, but it was a little difficult just at first doing it. I'd never done it before, and it was a bit difficult to do it, but once you got the trick, it wasn't very hard. You wouldn't want to go bouncing your thing along. You've got to keep it just off the ground.
It's a matter of getting the height right.
Getting the height right. And also, of course, getting a really straight run into the thing. And to a certain extent, that was the way it was laid out. It was easier, of course, if you were flying right into wind, because you wouldn't tend to drift over to the left or right. so that you could take it straight. And it was important to get in between the two sticks like this. There.
What sort of planes were you operating with during the second tour? Bristol fighters again?
No. This was these were the Wapitis. Though we were still equipped with Bristol fighters right at the beginning of my time there, and in fact I and another young man delivered, I think, the last Bristol fighters from in India from 31 Squadron down to Lahore to be done, to be scrapped. That was the end of the Bristol fighter. And then the Wapiti came in almost immediately after I arrived.
Did you find that this was an improvement, that the Wapiti was an improvement on the Bristol
fighter? Yes, in many ways it was. Mind you, the Bristol fighter was in its day a most excellent aeroplane, very good, most adaptable to any job, practically. But as its name implies, it started in the First World War as a two-seater fighter. It was meant for fighting, but of course it was very useful, especially in places like India, for all sorts of jobs. And it wasn't used for fighting out there. There wasn't any fighting to be done, air fighting, I mean. But it was an excellent aeroplane, but of course it did suffer from it. It was getting old and out of date and so on. And the Wapiti was an improvement, because it would carry more, carry a bigger bomb load, it would carry more, and it was more up to date. It also had an air-cooled engine, which was rather a good thing too, because you didn't get this trouble about radiators.
In 1934, you moved to New Delhi to take a post on the staff at the headquarters of the RAF,
yeah,
in India.
Yeah.
What were your duties in that?
Well, it was on what we called the air staff, that is, corresponds to general staff in the army, the operational side. But I was a squadron leader then, and the air staff, the chief member of our little air staff department was a wing commander, so I was number two, you see. And there again, it's very difficult to describe exactly what one did. I came into the operational side to a certain extent, but he mostly dealt with the actual operational side, and I was concerned with. Very largely, one of the principal jobs I took over from my predecessor was the development of the Far East route down to Singapore, which I never actually flew down. I regretted I couldn't manage it for some reason. I wanted to do it, but that was quite an interesting job, because it would have been more interesting if I'd been able to go down the route myself.
What did it involve?
Well, it involved... It involved the establishment of a number of landing grounds of a convenient range from each other, you see, for the range of the aircraft. And you had we had to establish various facilities like refueling and signals facilities and everything else, all that sort of thing. And one of the principal jobs in my office was preparing a book which had been written once before, but it badly needed a new one. I was spent a lot of time writing up this new book, a sort of brochure of the whole of the route, telling you on each page exactly what the airplane, what the aerodrome looked like, what its approaches were, etc., etc., its length and breadth and everything else. Prevailing winds, anything of that sort, any sort of information that should be of value to you. And then there was a certain amount, as far as I remember, about the nearby towns, if you wanted to get anything of an ordinary civilian nature, or got stranded down. It was quite an interesting job, but it was rather tedious.
You were able to collect this information without actually going to see the place?
Oh, yes, because a lot of it was all there already. It was only bringing it up to date, as far as I was concerned, and, of course, finding out from local resources. The Singapore, the Air Force in Singapore, for instance, would give us a lot of information about the things that were not actually in our. We were merely connecting up the whole India with Singapore, if you like to put it that way, and Burma and so forth. So they gave us a lot of information if we wanted it, and made a contribution. But we actually prepared the route book, I think it was called, for that route. And of course, it was also interesting because it was at a time before. Civil airlines had really got going very much. Imperial Airways was in existence, but they found it very useful to use the information that we had gathered for operational purposes, which was for reinforcement route. It was really in case of a reinforcement of any flying that had to be done for reinforcing Singapore, for example, or Burma.
Can you remember how many staging posts there actually were?
Oh, no, I can't, I'm afraid. There must have been, I suppose between a dozen and 20, something of that sort. Must have been. See, ranges of aircraft were not so very long. I think the Wapiti, I really can't remember I can't remember what, how many hours it could fly, but something up to 5 or 6, I suppose, not much more than that. So you see, at those sort of speeds, 100 miles an hour or so, 150 miles an hour perhaps, you didn't get so very far. You had to have fairly frequent staging posts in order to get fuel, etc.
Were each of these staging posts a small RAF base in themselves?
Well, they were organised by us and for us. What their complement was, I really can't remember. But the refuelling could be very largely done, of course, by the people who flew down the route. They knew what to do and what they wanted, and there must have been a certain amount of native personnel on each ground, but I shouldn't think, I really don't remember whether we had much in the way of Air Force personnel there. We might have had one or two chaps just to take charge, you know, probably did. I can't really remember the details of that. That's what it was for, anyway.
Did you manage to get out of the office much while you were doing this New Delhi job, or was it mainly desk work?
Not very much. It was mostly work in the office. I also had on my plate to run the aeroplane for the Viceroy. He had an aeroplane. That was really a very difficult one. Sometimes.
Why was that?
I'd like to tell you. It wasn't. It suffered. Funnily enough, from spells of not having enough spares. And the Viceroy's wife was very keen on this aeroplane. She always liked to show her friends. And if it wasn't in serviceable condition, she would get very angry. Now, this is really oughtn't to go down on the tape, I don't think. But and couldn't understand why it was. It wasn't ready, you see. Caused me a lot of trouble. The military secretary used to ring me up and say, what's happened to the aeroplane, and so on, and I'd explain. And of course, he understood, but she couldn't understand.
You didn't have to deal with her yourself, that was the military secretary.
Yeah, I didn't do it. I did it through her. She knew who I was, all right. And of course, I'd met her. And we used to go to the Viceroy's house every now and then. We became They're good friends in the end.
What sort of aeroplane did they use?
Well, they had an Avro that was brought out, a development of the old fashioned Avro, but of course this was a big, comparatively, a modern aircraft, monoplane with two engines, I think. And it had a nice, comfortable cabin and so forth, nice, comfortable seat. And they used to go touring about it, and she loved it. She thought it was marvellous, and it all had to be done with mauve curtains and that sort of thing, because she liked mauve. And well, there are some really funny stories I could tell you about it, but I don't think I'd better. But yeah, I only mention it because it occupied quite a lot of my time, and sometimes I regret to say unnecessarily. It was sorting out little troubles that really couldn't be helped. And that's only a detail, but then otherwise, it's awfully difficult to remember. There were, nowadays, exactly what it was. It wasn't, that particular job wasn't very cut and dried. It would range over various other operational matters, other than what I've just been speaking of, from time to time. But there was nothing very clear-cut about it. I mean, of course, naturally I had to be in the know about what the wing commander was doing, too, in case he was away or sick or anything, and I would have had to take over. So that we were all mixed up together. We worked in the same office, actually, so that at two different tables. So we were always closely in touch, and I was second string to him, as well as being... He didn't have anything to do with the Singapore route, for instance. I did that on my own. And I did the Viceroy's aeroplane on my own. And other, well, a few other things. I really can't remember now.
Were you involved at all in liaison with the army in that particular post?
No, not... well, of course, we were... Both of us, both the wing commander and myself, from any air staff point of view, that affected the army, and many of them did, because you see, we were still very much engaged and very subject, really, to what the army policy was. Still in those days, there was no separate air policy, really, at all. We all came under the commander-in-chief of the army, strictly speaking. But we had more freedom, in a way, by that time, although our air officer commanding was actually technically second string to the second to the commander in chief. He wasn't. He couldn't be completely ordered about. He could have his. He had a very big say in anything, and rightly so. But he wasn't a completely independent commander. That was what I mean.
Did you ever feel that the RAF was actually being held back from doing all that it might be?
Yes, we did sometimes, quite frankly. We thought that we could have been used with better effect on the frontier, on the lines of the air control system, than we were. And there were arguments about that sort of thing, from time to time.
Did you take part in any of the arguments? Were you involved in actually planning joint operations?
No, not. It wasn't really my job. It was the wing commander's job to do that. So that's where we divided. But I had to be sort of in on it in order to take his place if necessary. See?
And in those particular operations, the wing commander really was doing, and you were keeping an eye on. Did you feel it with any of those in particular that the matter might better have been left to the RAF?
Oh yes, I think there were two or three occasions when I thought not left to the RAF entirely, but that the general pattern ought to have put the RAF in a much more prominent position. When I say general pattern. Again, it's always difficult to describe these things unless you study the whole process of air control, which can run into many pages. It's not a thing one can describe in 5 minutes. But the point was that shall we say, supposing, for example, there was a row in a fairly distant place on the frontier, we felt that we could perhaps start the ball rolling by a bit of action on our part, which might well, if it was properly done, will reduce the trouble to such an extent that the army didn't have to go to the enormous expense and trouble of sending a column right up to the scene of action. Do you see what I mean? Now that was, and perhaps it would be fair to say that they didn't really believe that we could do that sort of thing for them quite enough. Eventually they started to believe it, of course, but they didn't really believe it, and there were times when we felt that would have been the way to do it, instead of sending an army column up and then asking us to protect it or something of that sort, you see, which was really doing the thing we thought, putting the cart before the horse.
So even by that stage in the mid-30s, although there had been quite a lot of evidence of the effectiveness of air control in Iraq, say, that's it still hadn't really sunk in India.
It hadn't sunk in, no. And, of course, I could understand it more in a way, because the commander-in-chief in India had been in a long, very long established post, and he had been accustomed to being in charge of all the operations. It was very satisfactory originally, of course, but then when he got this new arm, he was always rather tended to subordinate it to the then forces, where we said, we don't want to subordinate the army to the air force in any way, but we do think that it's making too clumsy a job of it to send a column up and then use the aircraft as a sort of hanger-on to help you, whereas in point of fact we could give far more help by starting the operation off in our particular way and probably save you an awful lot of trouble. But they didn't see it that way, and it was very difficult for them to see it that way because they'd never really had any experience of it. And I can quite understand that they couldn't, by nature, put quite so much trust in us as we did in ourselves. Mind you, supposing we'd been allowed to do it more often, we might have made a mess of it sometimes. Well, you might say the same about the army too, mightn't you? Or anybody else who was trying a job. You do make a mess of things sometimes. But there it was. That was the sort of differences of the opinion. That's the sort of way in which it arose. It's only an example.
But this, in fact, this difference of opinion, as it professional difference of opinion, as it were, didn't in any way affect your social relationships in the club with
army officers? Not at all. I mean, you might sit down and have a good old argument over a glass of beer with a soldier and express your views, but it was all perfectly friendly, of course, and except when one might get a little cross sometimes, I suppose, but we didn't do much with it. You might, you didn't talk shop in the club anyway, normally, but if you were by yourself with a soldier whom you'd had some dealings with over a matter like that and it wasn't disturbing anybody else, perhaps you might stoop to talking a little bit of shop in the club.
Win a few people over in a quiet way.
Yes, that's all right. But I mean, one wouldn't normally have used the club for any such purpose at all.